Greetings, everyone. Welcome to the Delta Flyers Journey Through the Wormhole with Quark, Dax, and their good friends, Tom and Harry. Join us as we journey through episodes of Star Trek Deep Space Nine. Your hosts along this journey are Terry Farrell, our enchanting science officer, Armin Shimmerman, our beloved entrepreneur, Garrett Wong, our forever ensign, and myself, your favorite helmsman, Robert Duncan McNeil. Today we have Armin. Armin, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Happy to be here.
Great to see you. And Garrett, good to see you, sir.
Yes, sir. Good to see you as well. I was so confused with, I thought that was actually Armin's house, but that's his
green screen. That's a fake background. That's a green screen.
That's a little bit of my Shakespearean library behind me, actually. It's a tiny bit of it. Some very important books, reference books for me are behind me.
Okay.
It's a picture. It's not the actual thing.
It's a photo of your Shakespearean library.
Armin, have you ever seen Ethan Phillips' library?
No, but I imagine it's extensive because he's an avid reader.
Yes. When I look at yours, it reminds me of Ethan Phillips. He's an avid reader and a book collector of, you know, first editions and really obscure and very interesting stuff. He's got an awesome library. I bet yours is equally awesome.
No, I don't think it is, but I probably have less novels than he does. Most of my books are reference books.
I see.
Okay.
I have a pretty good library. Garrett, you've seen my library.
Yeah, you do. You've got a lot of books. Megan has as many books as the library has, I think. Megan has so
Megan
many.
Oh, my loves gosh. To read.
Oh, my goodness. Yes. It's insane. But all, you know, both of you, all of us, I think, are avid readers, or we enjoy reading.
What else are we going to do with our free time?
Exactly.
I suppose you should read them, yes.
Speaking of avid readers, Armin is a writer. He's a novelist.
He is a novelist.
I want to make sure everybody knows that.
Yes.
Thank you.
You should be reading Armin's books.
You're right.
He's an amazing writer.
You're right.
Thank you. Thank you. I have two sets of books. Each of them are trilogies. First trilogy is science fiction. And the second set of trilogy is a political mystery about Shakespeare's times and including mostly historical people, but also some fictional people as well.
Everybody's got to check those out. By the way, Armin, I do have a message from Feroza Mehta to you. Mm-hmm. She went to the Guthrie bookstore, looked for your books, and they are sold out. So you need to make sure they get some more.
My goodness.
Yes.
That's good news. And I will get in touch with the Guthrie and say, hey, it's time to reorder some of my books.
Yes.
What was the last book that both of you read that you enjoyed a lot? The most recent book?
The George Washington book by Ron Cerno, the biography, George Washington.
Biography of George Washington.
Yes.
Okay, by
phenomenal.
Ron Cerno.
Phenomenal book.
Armin?
I'm reading a book right now by a man named, I believe it's Mike Heron. And he's the man who wrote the Slow Horses books, that Slow Horses, the TV show. If you haven't seen Slow Horses, by the way, you have to watch it.
Really?
It was, in my opinion, absolutely the best show on TV presently. And it's a wonderfully written book, both about the MI5, but also it's just incredibly, the way he's a great wordsmith. He puts words together phenomenally well.
I love authors who are great with language.
Just this one
paint a picture and surprise you as you're reading the book. Yeah. Wonderful. Awesome.
I love to hear that. All right, on.
Well,
okay.
For everybody listening to this podcast, we just want to remind you, if you want the extended version of this podcast with lots of amazing extra bonus material, sign up at patreon.com/thedeltaflyers and get your extra stuff.
Yes.
It's worth your weight in latinum.
Exactly.
Well said, Armin.
Well said.
I like that.
Do you have any birthdays, Garrett?
Yes, we do have birthdays, plural, but singular.
Okay.
So let's all three of us individually say happy birthday to Stacey Davis. Happy birthday, Stacey.
Happy birthday, Stacey.
Happy birthday, Stacey Davis.
March 7th.
Yes.
Mother's Day is almost here. And you can get her the most beautiful time-tested gift around. A watch she can wear every day for Movement. Whether mom's into classic dress watches, rare and refined ceramics, or tried-and-true bestsellers, Movement has something she'll love. And right now, you can save big on the best Mother's Day gift ever with up to 50% off site-wide during Movement's Mother's Day sale at MVMT.com. Again, that's up to 50% off at MVMT.com.
this is a tiny bit extenuated, so bear with me.
Yes.
I did some research on Wikipedia, and I wanted to know more about the idea of storytelling, because this episode is called The Storyteller. So, with your permission, I will read what I took down from Wikipedia. It says, storytelling, intertwined with the development of mythologies, predates writing. The earliest forms of storytelling were usually oral, combined with gestures and expressions. Some archaeologists believe that rock art was also an addition to a role in religious festivals, and it may have served as a form of storytelling for many ancient cultures. The Australian people painted symbols, which also appear in stories on cave walls, as a means of helping the storyteller remember the story. The story was then told using a combination of oral, narrative, music, rock art, and dance, which brings understanding and meaning to a human existence through the remembrance and enactment of stories. Thank you.
Wow.
Well described. Very well said. You know what this makes me think of? Your description of storytelling reminds me of my high school drama teacher, who was and still is a profound influence on me, Linda Wise. Mm-hmm. She brought in a couple of storytellers once that she had seen perform and tell stories at the storytelling festival in Tennessee. They came in to our theater class and told stories and talked about storytelling and how it sort of relates to acting and performing. And it was just fascinating. I was just amazed at how someone could capture and take you through a journey all by themselves. No sets, no lights, no props. They just sat on a chair or stood and told a story, and it was just captivating. I'd never seen anything like it. They were amazing storytellers. So yeah, what you describe is exactly what I remember experiencing.
And certainly all art forms in a sense come from storytelling. Certainly the Iliad and the Odyssey were stories that were eventually written down by various authors, although we call those various authors Homer. It is what we do. We are storytellers. We are part of the team that tells stories as entertainment and as education.
Armin, we had an episode of Voyager that was about a planet where stories were the most valuable. Mm-hmm. You know, they cherish stories more
than
money.
Their latinum. That was their latinum.
Stories.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And wasn't it Chakotay that had the stories, or wasn't he the one that went down there? And then I can't remember.
I think that was B'Elanna. Remember, she was crash landed on that planet, and that guy kept coming back. Tell me more about your stories.
We need that's to, right. You know, that's right.
So that
but
was
Star
one.
Trek. Yes. Yeah, Star Trek has definitely, visited this idea of storytelling as a human connector. Well,
one of the great things about the acting community that I've noticed over the several years that I've been involved in it is that actors, besides on stage and on film telling stories, they love to tell stories about experiences that they've had or seen. And those stories get retold over and over and over. I know that I have stories from older actors who've probably since passed away that I repeat to young actors because they were such wonderful stories that I heard from older actors.
Yeah, that's true. Absolutely.
My haiku for the storyteller. Ben to mediate. Chief must repel the Dao Rock. Nog falls for Varys.
that's wonderful. You know, structure, the story points that you hit in the order you hit them is almost identical to my limerick structure. Story points.
If I were the teacher and you were the students, I would accuse both of you of collaborating.
I know, wouldn't you? But we didn't.
Okay, let's hear it. Here you.
Here we go. Here's my limerick.
All right.
Sisko must negotiate with his best diplomatic technique. Around Varys, Nog forgets how to speak. O'Brien tries to tell the story, but Hovath gets all the glory. And Nog finally gets a kiss on the cheek.
Really good. Yeah. I like that one. Very
but
tight.
I started you with Sisko, went to the O'Brien, and then finished with Nog.
Yeah, with
it
Nog,
was exactly
same
your beats.
Thing. The same beats. There you go.
Now, I'm just going to give you a little background, since neither one of you wore prosthetics, that probably after Varys kissed Nog, the makeup person, her makeup person, probably had to come over and take all that orange off of
her lips. Yes.
In order for them to do the next take.
Yes.
Well, in this episode, don't you get a drink thrown in your on your prosthetics? You Varys throws a cocktail or her bubbly water.
Yes, but everything is, you know, sealed. So that probably didn't cause a lot of problems.
Yeah.
Probably enough for my makeup artist, the wonderful Karen Westerfield, to throw a hissy fit. But it wasn't too bad.
I thought about that. Whenever Nog sits at the railing and you see his hands grasping one of the bars there, is he leaving orange on the railing too?
Yes.
It's everywhere.
It depends on how well you seal the packs.
Yeah.
So if the packs is really sealed, it shouldn't leave anything. And it may be that Aaron is not gripping it as hard as you think he
That's
is
what I
in,
thought.
In order
yes.
to, you know,
to not leave it there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
How do they seal it, Armin? How
it's a
do
spray.
They...
Isn't it a sealant that sprays?
No, it's actually, as I remember, it was a lot of powder. It was a lot
powder.
Of baby powder.
Okay. So teleplay for this episode by Kurt Michael Benzmiller and Ira Stephen Bear. Do you remember Kurt Benzmiller?
Not at all.
At all? No.
But understand, for the first 3 years of our show, we never intermingled with the writers.
Wow.
Ever.
Yeah, we didn't really either.
Kurt Michael Benzmiller originally pitched this story for this episode during the first season of Star Trek Next Generation.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was a TNG pitch, and they didn't buy the pitch. So what happened was Michael Piller showed up to TNG season 3. That script was sitting still in the offices. He read it and he goes, I like it. He goes, I like it a lot. And every season of TNG that went on, season 4, 5, 6, 7, he kept bringing it up, saying, hey, guys, can we do this for this show? And they would say no. And so there was a no. But then once DS9 showed up, when they started doing DS9, I think they were scrambling for some scripts. And Piller was like, hey, what about this one? And he finally reached out to Benzmiller. He says to Benzmiller, hey, we're gonna buy your idea. We need you to write the teleplay on this and go. And he had to do this, I think, during Christmas time was when he was told to write this. And they were premiering the first episode, I guess, a couple months later. So they hadn't even shown any of the episodes of DS9. And this writer had to adapt the story and throw it.
To your people.
Now, the choice of Bashir and O'Brien being together was Ira Stephen Bear's doing. He said, like, I want to put these guys together, and this is the episode we're going to do it in. So
nice.
that's how that happened. But it's interesting how this script had been sitting there for years, practically a decade almost, right?
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, bam, they use it for DS9. So there you go.
Cool.
Yeah.
David Livingston directed this episode. This is his second episode for you guys, I think, now, right?
Right.
Great job by David Livingston. I always like watching his episodes.
The story behind this episode is based on Rudyard Kipling's short story, The Man Who Would Be King.
Oh, interesting. I did not know that. It did feel, it felt
did
something
you feel
about,
like that? Yeah.
It felt like it very, yeah, maybe literary just because of the storytelling element or something. It didn't.
Mm-hmm.
I like this episode. I'll just go out on a limb and say I really enjoyed it.
Well, it's also the first episode to show the beginning of the friendship between Bashir and O'Brien,
which I love.
It, which does, am I right to say this, Armin? It does become very tight towards the end of the season.
It's one of the more major relationships in our show. Yeah.
Yeah. So would you say this is the Tom and Harry of DS9 in a way?
I would say that, yes.
Oh, look at that. Here we go.
Except... Both of you are relatively equal in rank. Am I right in that?
You are
the lesser officer, but the junior officer.
But the junior officer, correct. Yeah. So I am, yes. But in reality, it's flipped in terms of, I see Julian being that innocent puppy dog like Harry Kim was. So even though he's higher in rank, I feel Harry's closer to Julian than Tom.
Absolutely, yes. It is one of our better relationships and eventually it changes. It's always there, but it drops off. And I won't give anything away by saying Bashir finds another companion that he spends more time talking with. But you'll see that as the episode progresses.
But I like this relationship.
And it's a good one. And they did a great job and they're wonderful at it. But eventually the writers coupled Bashir with somebody else. It's not a deep, dark secret. Garrick becomes his confidant.
Oh, really? Oh, that's very different too. Huh. Very, very different tone. It's exterior space shot. We've got a station log from Cisco.
I really love that space shot.
It's great.
The camera was below the station shooting up.
Yes.
And I thought, now it may have been done before, but that's the first time I noticed it.
From that angle?
Yeah. And I went, that's a great way to look at the station.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel like the last few episodes, they're in a real high point. I feel the VisFX guys, the VisFX team, they're in a high point of some of these space shots, because I said the same thing on the last episode we were talking with Terry about, and I felt like the model shots and the space shots were phenomenal.
Yeah, they're really good.
Cisco says, the Bajoran government has asked me to mediate a disagreement between two rival factions, the Paku and the Navat. At issue is a land dispute, which could trigger a civil war. So we get the stakes right out of the gate.
Yeah.
The first scene is in ops. We see that the Paku delegation is about to arrive. The Navat will be here in about an hour, we learn. Mm-hmm. And O'Brien asks Sisko if maybe he can be replaced on this away mission. O'Brien doesn't really want to go.
Yeah, he wants Ensign Boyer to go. That's who he wants.
Mm-hmm. Who, I don't know who Ensign Boyer
we
is.
We don't even know Ensign Boyer.
I don't know who Ensign Boyer is.
I don't think we ever see Ensign Boyer.
I've never met an Ensign Boyer.
I love when they talk about these characters that don't exist.
They don't exist. But he doesn't grant that request. Bashir arrives, and there's a medical emergency, and this entire Bajoran village is in danger of extinction. So we don't have the details exactly. Bashir's super excited for the mission.
He's very excited.
Yes, it will give him a chance to get to know O'Brien better, for them to both get to know each other better. And you can just look at the face that O'Brien makes. He's not happy that he's going on this thing.
He is not happy.
And it's clear that he's not a fan of Bashir. He's kind of like, he's annoyed by
him, which kind of surprised me. I'd never saw this before, that O'Brien was irritated by Bashir.
Yes,
I didn't any either. Of this. This I felt didn't like either. A brand new thing to me.
I agree. But
I think we're not writing well for Sid, for Bashir at that time. I think they were trying to make him too much of an ingenue, and Sid is not an ingenue. So I'm going to use this word, he's very loche. He's very laid back and, you know, relaxing on a couch. But I think over time they realized that was a mistake. And so even then, I guess the writers knew that because O'Brien was not happy about being with Bashir.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, I love the dynamic, but it felt new to me, but I loved it. It was a good setup.
But we've seen him being fresh-faced and energetic and gee whiz all the time. And that got stale after a while.
Yes.
I just mention about that first shot, though? Because we've never seen that angle before. David Livingston follows Sisko
from behind
as he descends into ops, which now gives us a true kind of glimpse into how tall, how much height there is in ops.
Yeah, when you see it from up looking down, you see.
Yes, because do you remember? Yeah. Remember when we recorded with Terry? Terry said ops is, there's a lot of levels. It's high, I kept thinking it's not that high, but from this shot, it's
you
very
see what she
steep.
Was talking about.
Oh my gosh, you totally do. And I thought, wow, what a great shot that he chose to show everyone kind of the scale of ops.
He did some very bold shots in this. Like I'll mention one later on.
And when we hit him, right? Okay.
Yeah. It's just very unconventional, more cinematic than TV, cookie cutter shots. And that's classic David Livingston.
One of the things that this episode does that I don't remember ever happening again is it says to us, there are warring factions on Bajor.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first, watching this episode, I said to myself, does that ever happen again, where there's internal struggles on Bajor? Now, Bajor has been occupied by the Cardassians for a long period of time. Mm-hmm. That's the primary conflict that I remember mostly from Deep Space Nine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But this idea that there are two warring factions arguing over property rights, that's the only time I think this is mentioned in our series during the course of 7 years.
Interesting. About the Bajorans. I always thought of them as a unified group
against
the Cardassians.
That's right.
But then you start to see these more subgroups and tribalism going on that I don't remember ever being referenced before. So great point.
I find it interesting that back to back, we have two episodes about warring factions. And this one, not only does it have it about the Paku and the Navat, but it also has it regarding the village that we go down to as well, because the history of that village where Bashir and
they were fighting amongst themselves.
There was civil unrest there too. So it's two back-to-back
episodes. What's going on with these writers strife. That they just think everybody can't get along?
Yeah.
Well, that is the essence of our show about people who shouldn't be able to get along, find ways to get along.
Right.
That is essential to Deep Space Nine.
So they're in the turbo lift. Sisko and Kira are together. And Sisko wants this first meeting between the Paku and the Navat leaders to be informal, just to get them talking to each other. Kira says just getting them to sit down together is an accomplishment. And she talks about a Bajoran saying that the people and the land are one, and that the land that is inhabited by the Paku and the Navat is some of the harshest on Bajor.
She's like saying they're as ruthless as the land that they live on. They are the badasses. They're going to be so scary.
Mm-hmm.
I love this setup. This turbolift scene is basically a setup.
It's
for
a setup.
Joke.
It's a setup for the airlock scene next.
Yes.
And as they come into the airlock door opens, and we see an older, tall, distinguished Bajoran gentleman walk out, and he steps to the side and to reveal the 15-year-old leader of the Paku, Varus Sul. And we're thinking, what? Did a little research, because I was wondering how old this character was supposed to be. Supposed to be 15, but in real life, the actress, Gina Phillips, was 22 when she filmed this.
Oh, wow.
So she's not a teenager, but she looks very young. So
she looks very young, yes. But she was a great actress. I thought she was great.
Oh, for sure.
I loved Kira and Sisko's faces. They see the little girl. She introduces herself as the Tetrarch of the Paku.
Yeah.
And she's very confident and a little combative in her introducing herself.
For sure.
Yeah, we go into the runabout now with O'Brien and Bashir. Bashir is, I love it. He's super chatty. Mm-hmm. He's just like Mr. Chatty Cathy.
Yeah.
He wants to know if O'Brien doesn't like him because O'Brien has been silent and hasn't been talking to him. And O'Brien sort of avoids a straight answer. And he says he was just thinking. And Bashir says, oh, What were you thinking about? And O'Brien covers and makes up. He says, oh, a diagnostic I need to run when I get back to the station. And oh, by the way, when Bashir asks O'Brien, what were you thinking about?
Yeah.
Rebecca turned to me and she goes, that's just like you, honey. You always say to me, what are you thinking? What are you thinking? Which is, I'm like,
is that
Bashir.
You? You're Bashir?
What are you thinking about? What do you think? Tell me what you're thinking. I do that all the time.
And do you give the same response that Gollum gave?
Yeah.
Well, Rebecca is the Gollum in this situation.
Right.
And I'm the Bashir.
Yes.
And yes, she does make
she
up
responds
something.
Like, or she's, she'll make it up.
Yes, exactly.
I love how at the end, though, he's like, you know what? It's not necessary to call me sir. He's like, oh, well, what would you like me to call you? How about just Julian? Well, okay. Is that an order or am I, what do you want? What do you want? It's so funny. This scene is, it's a good starting scene for these two, this relationship that is blossoming. Well,
And he says, you don't have to call me sir, call me Julian. Then we go to a space shot. They approach the planet. We go back in the runabout and O'Brien says, we've achieved stable orbit around Bajor. We can beam down anytime, Julian.
Cullum is an extraordinary actor.
His comic timing was perfect on that. Am I right? He's so good. I'm so impressed. That's tough to do. Am I right, Robbie, in terms of having the timing to put that pause in for just enough,
just knowing exactly how to make something out of a pretty straightforward line.
God,
he turned it into something.
Such a good job.
And I love, Armin, you had mentioned to us before that Cullum and Sid both learned their lines very last minute.
Right. Now, whether they were doing it in the first season, I don't know. But certainly in later seasons, it was always a surprise to me that neither one of them even knew what the scene was about when they came in to read it in front of the director. That's how good they were. They were able to synthesize everything that they'd learned from the director's rehearsal and have it memorized and figured out in their minds in the 20 minutes or so it took to light the scene. Extraordinary.
I would be terrified.
I couldn't do it.
We go to the village square and Bashir and O'Brien beam down into this town square, and it's called the town square, I guess, but it's really a big circle. It's not a square. The town circle, they should call it.
The town
anyway,
circle.
Yes. Bashir scans around the area, but finds nothing dangerous. They were expecting that everyone was in danger. This was an emergency call, right? But they're like, what's going on? There's nothing here. A man runs up. His name is Farron.
Jim Jensen. Who I had worked with extensively on another project. Very happy to see Jim Jensen there.
He was great. He was awesome.
By the way, that village, the Shiraz village, was constructed on stage 18.
Yes.
And Herman Zimmerman, the production designer, had 7 days to construct that.
Well, the last episode was all in the cave set, and where that circle is where the shuttle crashed. So they had to get the shuttle out of there and all that debris and the fire torches. They'd get all that out of there and build that circle. Wow.
Yeah. And the company was off the stage for only 3 of the 7 days. So they only had 3 days really to do that, which is insane.
It is extraordinary that the set designers, the costume designers, both get this script maybe a week, 10 days at the very most, but a week before we actually start shooting. They have to design it. They have to come up with the concept. Mm-hmm. They have to get their crew in there to do the work, to sew the costumes, to build the sets, and get it all done in time to start the episode in a week. And for us, for the actors, I don't know about you guys, if we were lucky to get the scripts 48 hours before we started shooting an episode.
Yeah. 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 We would get it a day, maybe the day before, maybe like you said, 2 days, if you were lucky,
before you started.
The exterior shots of the village were reused from a Next Generation two-parter, Birthright Part 1 and Birthright Part 2.
So that's
the exteriors. This is interesting. Dan Curry created the final scene by inserting shots of the miniature into jungle photographs he had taken in Laos in the 1960s.
Those Peace Corps trips he took were very productive. He's got a lot of photos from being in the Peace Corps.
He has a lot, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. So, well, so they're in this town circle. Farron Cog runs up, introduces himself much better than I introduced him. And he says, this village is in great jeopardy, even though they just had the readings that nothing's dangerous.
Right.
They have to go quickly. So we go inside this chamber where they find this old man in bed. And Farron asks this other Bajorant, Hovath, who we'll get to know more later.
Yeah.
Asks Hovath if he's improved, but Hovath says no. And now Brian wants to know where the other sick people are. Like, if this village is in such danger, where's the other sick people? And Farron goes, no, there's no other sick people. But if he dies, Sarah, this guy in bed, if he dies, we all die.
Yeah.
Very mysterious.
It's very mysterious. The actor that played Sarah is K.E. Cutter. Or Cooter, I don't know how you pronounce that, but
he looks so familiar to me.
Me too.
He has done a lot of stuff. If you look at his resume and his, also he comes from a Hollywood family, so even his parents were already doing it even back then. And another thing that's interesting is, do you remember how early episodes of Bajoran had a different ridge on their, an extra thing on their forehead? A lot of these background Bajoran in this village have the same old school horizontal ridge. Yes,
interesting. That's another. Interesting.
Makeup note.
Well, we go into Quark's back room here. Like, I guess it's a private dining area of some kind. Armin, is that what it is?
I don't know. I'm not sure it is part of Quark's. It might be a meeting room for the station, because that sort of room shows up often, actually, in the course of the 7 years of Deep Space Nine.
I just assume, since you brought the drinks in, that it was like a little private dining area or something.
Quark could have been catering the party.
Room service kind of thing.
Room service, I'm not sure where it takes place.
Interesting. Okay, so in this mystery room, there are two rival Bajorans, Wobon, who is an older man.
He's the Navat, played by Jordan Lund.
And Varys, this teenage girl, who is sitting with Sisko and Kira, and Sisko wants to get kind of an informal get together before official negotiations start later that night. Mm-hmm. We learned that in the scene that this river that divided their territory was diverted by the Cardassians. Dang Cardassians.
Yeah, for mining stuff.
Divert an entire river. And so it changed the dividing point of these two groups. And now the Paku have more land. And so Varys says that's how the treaty reads, wherever the river is. And so she's kind of holding firm to the treaty, and this guy Wobon wants their land back now that the Cardassians are gone. Mm-hmm. Quark arrives. He's got everybody a drink. He seems to give everyone an alcoholic beverage. And then he gets to Varys and he says, he gives her her Trixian bubble juice for the little lady, he says.
Just the name itself, Trixian bubble juice. It's so like,
so
I love it.
Childish. It's like a Shirley Temple.
Shirley Temple for the little lady.
Yeah,
the
little she doesn't lady. Like little lady.
Mm-mm. No, she's very insulted, throws the drink in Quark's face, and she storms out.
Robbie, were you shocked when this happened? Because I was. I was like, you just threw that drink on Armin? Yes. I was really shocked.
Thank you for that, Garrett. It's very sweet.
You know when people have a jump scare in horror movies? I jump scared when the liquid hits you. I'm like, because of the makeup? You?
Then I would recommend to you that you don't watch a lot of our episodes because everything is always thrown at me one way or another.
Do you get do you get drinks thrown in your face a lot?
I don't remember any, but there probably are. But probably. Everybody grabs me by the lapels, you know.
Yes.
Everybody.
You get manhandled. I get it.
I get manhandled.
No respect.
No respect.
Sorry, it hurts me because I know who you are. So
you have to remember I was 25 years younger then. Yes, so it's okay. True. It's all right.
Okay.
So.
Okay.
Well, Quark does say that he's still charging her for that Trixie and bubble juice, which I love.
But I love it how calm Quark is, though. He's like, I'm still charging her for that drink. He doesn't flip out. He doesn't get offended. He just
perfectly
says,
delivered. Yeah, perfectly comedically delivered.
Love it. I'm already aware of how badly I'm going to be manhandled for the rest of the show, so I take it in stride.
Okay, good.
Exactly. Okay, so we're at the promenade now. We've got Nog and Jake. They're sitting up on that special spot that they love in the corner of the balcony. I love that spot. Yep. I don't know who invented it, if it was David Livingston. I think that's the first time I remember seeing it.
Mm.
But it's a great... It's just so good for their characters.
Great location to shoot. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so they're bored. Jake wants to play baseball in the holodeck. Nog does not. He thinks baseball is a boring game.
Were you upset by that, Robbie, when he said that?
I'm not as much a baseball guy.
What?
When we were on Voyager, I was a huge baseball guy.
You were only baseball.
I was only
point.
Baseball. I've transitioned to my college football obsession now.
Okay,
so
okay.
Baseball's, it's a nice pastime.
I thought it was a surprising statement from Michael Piller, who was a huge baseball fan, for him to have a character say, I'm like,
it's
crazy.
It's slow and boring.
That was an inside joke. It was like, oh, that's just Michael,
that's what everybody says to Michael. That's what he hears from people all the time.
Right. Yeah. So this was this was a dig sort of from the writers at Michael, like, ha ha ha.
Or I'm sure Michael had to read the script and approve it because he was the showrunner.
Yeah.
God knows what Ira had to say in order to keep that line in. So.
Right.
Exactly.
So they're sitting there discussing what boring things they can do, arguing about baseball. And then Odo appears, tells them they can't sit like that, orders them to stand up. And as soon as they're standing, he says, thank you. He leaves and they sit right back down.
They sit right back down.
Yes.
Rebellious
children.
You know, you gotta pay attention to Uncle Odo. If Uncle Odo tells you to get up, just respect the man, please. Yeah.
They sit back down and then Nog spies. He sees Varys for the first time and his breath is taken away. He thinks she is the most beautiful thing he's ever seen, runs off to meet her. And Jake stands up and sort of follows. He's not quite as enthusiastic or taken, but yeah. Nog is
kind of Harry Kimish in a way,
very Harry Kimish,
and kind of Garrett Wongish in a way back in the day.
Exactly.
Okay,
we go back to the old man's chamber down on the planet, Sarah's chamber. He wakes up.
Sarah, by the way, is an interesting name.
It is
for me, who's a Shakespearean scholar.
Yeah,
because Sarah is a title of address that's diminutive. You call someone Sir, and that's respectful, but if you call someone Sarah, it's less than respectable. It's just saying, hey, guy, Joe, whatever.
Oh, wow.
It doesn't have anything to do with respect.
Is it condescending or is it more casual?
It is condescending.
It's condescending.
It's condescending.
Oh my goodness. Whereas he is the
esteemed guy.
He's on top of the totem pole here. But in the Shakespearean world, Sarah is a cad almost.
Or Sarah. Actually,
Sarah. All right.
Where goest thou, Sarah?
Where are you going, buddy? Hey,
buddy.
Hey, Mac. Hey, bud. Yeah, where are you going? Okay. Thank you for
that. Well, this scene, so he wakes up, wants to know what time it is. He's got 2 hours till sunset, till nightfall. Mm-hmm. And he goes, oh, good. He meets Bashir, thinks that he's the prophet, thinks that he's the one that the prophet sent. But then when he holds his hand, he realizes, no, you're not the right guy. And he says, what about your companion? Where's your companion? And Bashir calls O'Brien over, and Sarah holds O'Brien's hand. And he goes, yes, you're the one. Prophets did not fail me. And he says, okay, you can both leave. And so it's very confusing. He's like, he's found some important guy the prophets talked about, but then he's like, okay, you can go.
Yeah.
By the way, this is a oner, this scene. There are no cuts in this entire scene.
Mm-hmm.
Very cinematic, more movie style and than TV
very
style.
Very David Livingston.
Very well. David Livingston. Yeah. It's not a complicated shot. It's just a simple kind of tableau of the bed. Yeah. People coming and going, but yeah. it is a rare oner, right. And a very bold thing to do as a TV director myself. When you do a oner, you take away the ability for the producers or studio or anyone to choose performances.
Yeah,
they're stuck with this one long shot. They can pick which take they like, but they can't edit in any way.
Correct.
So it's a very bold move for David Livingston to do a oner.
Yeah,
you can get in trouble for that.
When he held Bashir's hand and then he held O'Brien's hand, online it says that he was checking their paw, and I thought if you check a paw, you gotta grab that ear. Yeah. So did it look like he was trying to grab O'Brien's ear a little bit, like his face, or did it always be the? It was always the hand.
I thought it was just the hand.
Just the hand. So maybe you can check paw that way too. So
okay. All right. Well, we go outside in the village square, and Farron asks how Sarah is, and Bashir says he's succumbing to old age, that there's nothing Bashir can do. He's going to die a natural death, but he's an old man, and he's going to depart soon.
Yeah.
Farron is terrified. Mm-hmm. Without Sarah, the Dal Rock, this terrible creature that lives out in the woods, is going to destroy the entire village. So Farron is terrified. But Farron does say that this Dal Rock thing comes every year. Once a year at the end of harvest, it appears.
For five consecutive nights.
Mm-hmm. So this is a once a year thing, but it's a big deal. For five nights, they got to defend themselves against the dog.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We go back to the station in a corridor. Nog and Jake are approaching Ferris's door, and they're arguing over who's going to ring the doorbell. I love that they literally start like, it's like Three Stooges
fighting,
style. They're like fighting each other.
You're afraid. No, I'm not. You are. No, you're afraid. Oh my gosh, guys. Yeah.
Yes. But Varys opens the door and she's like, what are you guys doing? And Nog is completely tongue-tied. He cannot put two words together. He says, my name is Jake.
Jake.
No. And then Jake, who's fine, he's calm. He says, he's Nog. I'm Jake. And they walk into the room. They just walk right past her, which I thought was kind of bold.
Didn't you find fault with that scene? Like, who walks right into somebody's quarters without
teenagers?
Being invited? Teenagers.
And not only that, did you see where Jake put his feet? Puts his feet up on the table. I go, whoa, who does that?
But she seems to be okay with it. Like, she is
didn't
a kid
say anything.
Too. She's supposed to be a kid like them. They're all.
Yeah.
Kids, relax, not uptight like the grown-ups. Varys has to be, and we see this in the episode, like Varys is trying to put on this adult strength and be like her father, but she really is more comfortable around the kids. And that's what I felt like that scene, why it was staged that way, you know, that she's okay with it. She's actually more comfortable in a weird way with kids.
Okay, that makes sense. Okay, so you drop all the niceties and the formalities, you know,
the adult
that
stuff.
Adults
they,
have. Yeah,
yeah, they act like kids. They put their feet up.
That's fine.
They don't ask permission.
I'll buy that.
And what kid throws a drink in an adult's face? That's what I'm asking. That's what I mean.
Yes. But they come in. They offer. Jake offers to give her a tour to maybe look at the wormhole. There's this Klingon freighter is going to go to the Gamma Quadrant. She agrees, and Nog is like,
oh my god,
ecstatic about this.
No.
Aaron's very funny in this scene. This whole episode, actually.
He is. He really is. Okay.
By the way, I want to say I love in this episode that there's two equally entertaining stories. There's an A story and a B story. They kind of have themes that echo, but they're both entertaining stories. I love them.
I don't even say B story. I say A and A minus. I mean, they're very, I mean, they balance.
Or two A stories.
Yeah. Or two A storylines, right?
Yeah. They're both great stories.
Okay.
But we go back to the village. The old man, Sarah, is helped up onto this big rock outcropping by the village square. Mm-hmm. Bashir's telling him, you know, you should go back to bed in your condition, but he ignores Bashir. And suddenly this wind appears when he's up on this big rock stage almost. It's like a
promontory.
It's like the Lion King.
He's in the lion. This outcropping of rock, like the Lion King. Yes.
It is absolutely the Lion King.
He goes up there. This wind comes. O'Brien's checking the tricorder. He's like, I don't know. What is this? He can't seem to get any readings. But this huge cloud appears above them. That's the Dull Rock.
Yeah.
Sirrah starts to speak. He calls for the village to be strong. Defeat the Dull Rock. The Dull Rock gets closer. This energy burst hits the village. And Sirrah collapses at the end of this scene.
Yeah.
He collapses, falls down, appears to be dead. And the act break goes out on O'Brien going, oh, bloody hell, which I loved. It's very funny.
But before he collapses, he tells the story, he leads the villagers sending their energy, and you see that little energy beginning to repel Dalrock.
Maybe,
you see that
for
a second, but then he falls. Isn't there a beginning?
Yeah, there's a little, like the village, these light particles are going back towards the Dalrock. Basically, the energy from the village and the energy from the Dalrock is sort of competing, but the Dalrock seems to be winning.
Especially when the guy falls.
It falls down. Yeah. Oh, bloody hell. Anyway, we come back from our little break, and Bashir's trying to help, but Sarah wants his successor, that the prophets had sent him. That's O'Brien. O'Brien says, I'm not your guy. Mm-hmm. Like, no, thank you. But Sarah asks him just to come say what I say, basically. Yes. So O'Brien starts repeating these words that Sarah gives him. Sarah starts whispering the word.
Yeah. And he says, say it louder so they can hear. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But it does inspire the village to kind of send this energy particles back to the Dull Rock. It sends the Dull Rock away, you know.
But Dull Rock is defeated.
O'Brien telling the story. It's so funny. Like when I saw the promo or like the little capture on Paramount Plus where I watch it.
Yeah.
I thought this was going to be, this is Colm Meaney's Irish heritage. He's going to be a great storyteller. But no, he's a horrible storyteller. No. he's awkward and doesn't really want to do it.
I have a quote from the repelling of the Dull Rock scenes here in the village. So here it is. On the filming of the scenes where the villagers face the Dull Rock, David Livingston commented, we had 30 extras, wind and lightning. They were really difficult working conditions. I had to use a bullhorn in order to communicate since I had lost my voice. It's physically very demanding on everybody to work on stage 18. The actors had to have big wind machines blowing in their faces, and it was very debilitating. But we got through it. It was fun. Screaming through a bullhorn is a real power trip. This is the end of Livingston's quote.
David.
It's funny.
That's funny.
God knows how many takes.
Oh, I know. Yes. That's the thing. Part of the reason why he lost his voice is because he does too many takes, and he's screaming over the wind machine. So there you go.
Mm-hmm. All right, to finish this scene, so O'Brien does repeat the words. They send the Dull Rock away, but Sarah collapses again. This time, he's dead. he's done. Farron tells the village that they have a new Sarah who will lead them and keep them safe, and that is O'Brien.
O'Brien.
Yeah, there's his calling.
The man who would be king. Yes.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. How does Bashir even... He didn't have a tricorder. He didn't even... I mean, within seconds, he knew he was dead. I was like, oh, I guess he's really good at that. You know, it didn't even look like he was touching his pulse.
He felt his paw. His paw.
He felt the paw. The paw was gone. Okay.
O'Brien's the new hero. We go to Quark's now. Quark is finishing a story to mourn. He sold them a whole herd of Klingon targs is the end of the story. I want to hear the beginning of the story, though. I want to know how that happened.
So do I.
Did they write? They must have written these lines for. I mean, this isn't something you could improv or play with, right?
Nothing was improv ever.
ever. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So this was written for you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the whole herd of Klingon Targs is the end of the story. And then Kira enters. And this is not a common thing, Kira coming to Quark's bar. She asks for a drink. Quark asks her how negotiations are going. And Kira says, you know what? You better make it a double.
Yeah.
Clearly, negotiations are not good. And so Kira's in Quark's and drinking, which I've never seen either of those things happen.
And you won't see very much of.
Yeah. Well, look at Quark's line. Major, what a pleasant surprise. I always look forward to one of your infrequent visits.
Exactly. It's
well written right there. We know what's going on. And Armin, good job on pouring only just enough for a single, because that vial looked a little bit, that carafe looked quite heavy, to be honest. It wasn't balanced very well, I don't think.
One of the great traumas of my life when I was shooting the series was pouring drinks. Pouring drinks was a trauma.
It's dramatic.
I can't tell you how many takes where I missed the liquid, missed the glass altogether.
Oh,
just to see it.
Yeah, because I'm looking at the actor and I'm dealing with the bottle and you know, and sometimes the pours weren't accurate. So yes, I'm very happy that I got it right.
Yes, you did.
But God knows how many takes it took to get it right. So
yeah. Right. Okay.
I like that she ordered a Star Drifter too.
Yeah.
Which I just happen to have in my hand.
In your hand. Yeah.
Yes. We go to the commander's office. Varys comes into Sisko's office. I guess he's asked to see her. And she's pretty combative right off the beginning. And he asks if she really wants to negotiate at all or if she just wants to start a war.
Mm-hmm.
And she says that she is ready to die for this principle, for her people.
Mm-hmm.
And Sisko says, are your people ready to die? And she decides to leave, tells him she'll see him at the negotiation table. So looks like she's digging in hard.
He is.
This young Varys girl.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of my favorite moments in this episode, actually, because she is a young person, a little lady. The young don't always do what they're told.
Yeah.
That's an in-joke for anyone who's listening. The young are often ready to go head over heels into battle with anyone, actually. Mm-hmm. And here's the older, not necessarily wiser, but the older person in the room, Sisko, offering a bit of maturity. Mm-hmm. And I rather like that. The actress took that in and went, oh, that's a good point. So there's a sense of her maturing at that moment from listening to what the older, wiser Sisko is telling.
Yeah.
I rather like that moment a great deal.
I agree with you. You saw it. It's not enough yet for her to change kind of her position, but Sisko is making some headway with her. You can see it. You see, it's a great scene. Really nice scene. We go to the promenade next. I think Nog and Jake are looking around for Varys. Nog reminds Jake that she's mine. I saw her first. And Jake says, you know what? You're so nervous. You can't even put two words together to talk to her. It's very funny. The boys being boys. They stumble into her as they go upstairs. She's sitting in their favorite balcony spot.
Yeah. They're still in the mid-conversation. Like Nog almost ruins it at this point.
Yes. Yeah. Because Jake says, you must really like her. And Nog says, I never said that. All I said was,
oh, hey, Varys. How are you?
They sit down with her. She's in the middle, though. I love that little tableau, the three of them up there.
Yep.
And she asked the boys for advice. And Jake says, well, I always talk to my dad. Nog says, my dad's pretty smart, too. Sort of.
She asks them, like, okay, so does it help? Because both of them talk to their dad. And then Jake says, yes. And Nog says, no, it doesn't help talking to Rom.
Yeah. They have very different perspectives on fatherly advice.
They have different fathers. Definitely.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that will change. That will change.
Okay.
Yes, I have no doubt. Varys does say, though, that her parents are dead.
Mm-hmm.
She reveals that to the boys here.
Mm-hmm.
And as Jake is starting to recommend talking to his dad again, Odo shows up and the three of them just run off.
Yeah,
because the boys know what that means when Odo shows
up. Nog does throw a little bit of a barb in there when he says, could we please talk about something besides your father? He's really upset.
Yes.
he's you know what? He's not upset. He's jealous. That's what it is. He's very jealous right at this point.
Well, he can't speak as well about Rom at this point as Jake can say about Sisko. And again, I remind everyone, again, the element of family is injected into Deep Space Nine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And different kinds of family, different kinds of relationships.
Yeah.
We go back down to the planet, back to our other A story in Sarah's chamber. Bashir is, this is the scene I want to talk about. Bashir's eating an apple And O'Brien is pacing, and he paces in and out of the frame. And we don't see O'Brien for a lot of his dialogue. Again, a bold shot from David Livingston, but it's perfect for the comedy because Bashir's eating this apple and enjoying O'Brien's panic about being this new, the new Sirrah. Great shot with O'Brien pacing in and out.
Perhaps we should have seen him just dealing with the fact that he's in over his head, that he doesn't know what to do. I actually would have liked to have seen his distress at being in this situation.
I would say, Armin, I think this is a great example. Your thoughts and my thoughts about watching, it's a great example of how directors do have an impact on storytelling. That directors and the choices they make can have a huge impact. Because here, and I always talk to directors about when they're coming up with their plan, have a point of view. You need your director's point of view, and you also need to know which character's point of view the scene is about. And what David Livingston chose was Bashir's point of view.
Yeah.
And I think what you're saying is, I want to see O'Brien's point of view. Yeah, and he didn't
choose the man who will become king.
Yeah.
Then we would need to see him dealing with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you didn't. What you saw was a comic Bashir experience of O'Brien's panic.
Right.
So,
yeah.
But I did laugh, whether it was right or wrong. I did laugh at the choice that Livingston made.
Yeah.
Villagers start to arrive with gifts. It seems that there are three women that seem to be part of this offering.
Yes, they're a different type of gift. There's food. There's also, you know, some like jewels maybe, and also females are offered.
Yes.
Yes.
Three women seem to be part of that. O'Brien says, no, I've got a wife and child back on the ship. And Farron sends them off.
Farron's like, oh, then you've got to bring them here. They're going to live here with you.
Yeah. Yes. Bring your wife and child here that they can live here with you because you're going to stay and protect us now.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to stay and tell the story. And then Farron leaves. And O'Brien basically says at the end, you know, we've got to find out what this Dalrock really is. And we've got to destroy it. Like, I can't.
I can't stay be here.
Yeah. I like in the scene, Bashir at one point, he goes, you know, for all we know, maybe you were really sent by the prophets. And O'Brien goes, I was sent by Commander Sisko.
Which ironically, this is giving away to me.
I know where you're going.
The writers didn't know that, but it's ironic. It's ironic.
It's true both ways is what it is. Essentially.
That's right.
So we will learn that later when we watch further. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So we go to a station log supplemental here. We have completed the second day of talks between the Paku and the Nevat. Sisko says, so far, we are no closer to finding a solution than we were when the negotiations began. So the young Varys is sticking to her gun. She is not going to give up this land.
Mm-mm.
We go to Varys' quarters. Jake and Nog go to visit her, and they invite her to do something, but she says, no, not right now. And then she asks Nog about opportunity, what he said about opportunity. How can you be sure that it's worth the risk?
Mm-hmm.
And here Nog really rises to the occasion and talks about the rules of acquisition. And he says,
this is the first time we hear the ninth rule of acquisition, I might add. Okay. He talks about instinct. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And opportunity.
Instinct plus opportunity equals profit.
Mm-hmm.
And she admits that really helps. Like, it makes sense to her with what she's trying to struggle with here.
Yeah.
And Nog is so happy that he helps. He wants to celebrate. And he says, let's go steal Odo's bucket for fun. Which doesn't seem like, I don't know. That's not a celebration to me, but.
But to them it is, because they're teenagers. This episode marks the very first appearance of Odo's bucket.
Ah, yes.
You don't see it before. It's mentioned, but you don't see it until now.
Yeah. So they go down. Nog has this security rod that he got from his dad.
Not from his dad.
It's from his uncle. It's from
Quark. From his uncle. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. From Quark.
It's again the security liquid. Yeah.
Yes. But they wait. Varys is like still confused. What's funny about a bucket? She doesn't get it. Yeah. Jake explains that Odo turns to goo and he sleeps inside of it. And that's when Nog opens the door and waves them inside Odo's office.
Yeah.
And it seemed pretty quiet there in the promenade. It seems like, it was a little late, or they were safe.
I got the sense it was late at night, although day and night must be, problematic when you're in outer space. There's nothing to tell you day, what's day and what's night.
I love how he, when he comes back in, because he leaves both Varys and Jake standing at the beginning of the office, and they're, you know, Varys is a little nervous. Varys is like, I don't know if this is okay. I mean, is this bad? And he's like, no, we're not really stealing anything. But when Nog comes out and says, found it, he trips. And it just reminds me of every time Aaron would do fake trips during the Vegas convention at my table. Like, he would trip at my table and fall into my table, knock my photos would be knocked onto the floor. He would fall into my booth and everything.
He did a fake trip?
He always did that as a joke to me and Megan, right? So here he's doing the fake trip, falling forward, and all the liquid of what is supposedly Odo gets spilled onto.
Yeah, Jake is terrified at first. Yeah,
he's like, oh my God, Odo! Yeah.
Horrified for a moment that it's Odo, and then Nog starts laughing hysterically. I love Aaron's laugh in this whole scene.
But that laugh is very Aaron Eisenberg. You know what I'm saying? He does that all the time. He did that all the time. And it's so, and he brought that into the character, which I love.
Yeah, it was great. Mm-hmm. They're laughing hysterically. Nog does reveal that it's just oatmeal from the replicator.
And that's and when as he they throws
all,
it at him. Yeah,
they all start laughing and throw food fighting. And that's when Odo walks in.
Yeah.
Nog panics. He runs for it out in the hallway. Sisko grabs him and says, hey, what's the rush? So these kids are in trouble.
They've just invaded the security officer's office.
Yes.
They've messed around with the private property of the security officer.
Very important private property, too.
And there's nothing. These kids are in trouble. Got it. But shouldn't there have been more?
Yeah.
Shouldn't somebody have gotten a lecture? Oh, certainly Nod should have gotten a lecture. But I think also Jake should have gotten a lecture. And what is the head lady in the negotiation doing?
Yeah. Playing around with the kids, breaking and entering, stealing buckets. You
know, all we get is we'll talk about this. And I go, there should be something more.
Does Odo smile during this scene? Does he have a bit of a
smile? No, he smiles in another scene.
Okay.
Which is the most phony thing I've ever seen Renee do on film.
Well, the note.
That smile was beyond wrong.
The note on Memory Alpha is that this is the second episode in which we see Odo smile. The first was two episodes prior in Vortex. And in both cases, Odo smiles as a result of interacting with children. Yeah. So that's
interesting.
So the smile you saw was the fakest smile you've ever seen.
The fakest I've ever seen. It's the phoniest thing I've ever seen
that Renee has ever done. Right? Okay. Okay. Good.
That's funny.
Now we know.
All right. We go back to the village. O'Brien and Bashir scanning rocks around the village that exploded.
Yeah.
They find some residual neutrino levels, and so they think maybe there is some kind of mechanism behind all of this, but they're not sure. They can't figure it out.
It's confusing.
Yeah. A villager with a baby comes up, wants a blessing from O'Brien here.
Can you imagine auditioning for that part? I looked at that and went, how do you audition for that?
I know.
Yeah.
But he does. He touches the baby's head, right?
Yeah. He kind of says, what does he say? I'm sure she'll make you very proud.
That was his blessing.
Yes. Yes. I'm sure she'll make you very proud. It's kind of pathetic. This crowd arrives and they all want blessings, and O'Brien runs for it. He's going to go search Sarah's room, and Bashir stays back to hold the crowd back.
Hold the crowd back.
and continue searching around the rocks. But we do see at the end of the scene, creepy Hovath. I didn't trust Hovath the first time I saw him. That creepy shot, I definitely don't trust him.
We find out that Hovath is his apprentice in this scene. We thought maybe he was a caretaker, sort of maybe a nurse or something in the beginning.
Or
right?
Perhaps,
he was
a son
maybe, yeah. Or a relative, whatever. But now we know this is the apprentice. Yeah.
Well, we learn this in the room. O'Brien's searching around the room. Hovath creeps in. Creepy Hovath. O'Brien asks what he did. Hovath says he was the apprentice. And O'Brien says that, he wants to know some of the secrets. But Hovath is like, well, if you're the Sarai, you should know all the secrets.
Right?
So we see a little bit of a conflict between these two. And then O'Brien turns his back towards a mirror. Luckily, there was a mirror because he could see Hovath with a knife coming to stab him. And he turns around. There's a bit of a struggle. Bashir runs in, sees through the window what's going on, runs in, and they struggle with this knife, but they disarm him. And he reveals that he is the true Sarah.
Right.
Basically, he claims that he is the true Sarah.
I wonder if that's a typical Bajoran dagger. Is that how they all look? Because it was very different looking from everything I've seen. So
it was probably a rubber prop, just for safety.
Yes, it was a rubber prop. Yeah, yes, you're right. I did read that.
They would have a rubber prop there. Mm-hmm. So that might have been what made it look different.
Yeah.
But that's the act out when he claims to be the true Sarah. We come back and Hovath explains he studied for 9 years. He was supposed to take over, but when he was given a chance to tell the story, he failed.
Yeah, this was 3 nights ago, right?
So
this
is the basic.
Yeah, he got nervous.
Mm-hmm. He couldn't control the bracelet.
Right. What does it have? A little piece of the orb.
A fragment of the orb.
A fragment of the tear of the prophet.
Tear of the prophets. Yeah.
Yes. And he does tell, this is where he tells them, Garrett, that long ago this village was divided by hate and distrust.
Yes. Yes.
And the first Sarah used this orb fragment to bring their collective fears to life. And then he had them focus their collective energy to work together and defeat their fear.
Yes.
Yeah.
And defeat the hate.
Yes. But none of the villagers know this secret. They have no clue that the Dalrock is really their own anger towards each other and that civil unrest that they had many, many, many years ago.
Yeah.
And if I may put a fine point to it, I think that is the crown jewel of this episode, is that little speech about focusing a community's energies to dissolve hate. I think, wow, that's what I watched Star Trek for.
Oh, yeah. Totally.
Yes, I agree. This story concept is the theme, is the big idea. And it's well articulated, well written. But O'Brien tells Sarah, well, you're going to have another chance tonight. Farron arrives and O'Brien tells him this, that he wants Hovath to tell the story. And Farron's like, no way. We can't let him tell the story again. He failed. O'Brien's got to be the one to do it. So O'Brien's not happy about that.
No.
Well, would you want to wear those clothes? I wouldn't want to put that robe on either.
So no.
By the way, did you notice? Very tacky.
Very tacky.
Have you noticed the color schemes that both Robbie and I chose are very similar to the Sarah's robes, the Bajoran colors? Did you notice that, Robbie? Don't you do that on purpose?
I did not. No.
You did it arbitrarily. Look at that.
Arbitrarily.
I kind of felt, hey, I want to get in that kind of color scheme and look at that. This is the Sarah's clothing, basically.
Okay, so next we go to the commander's office. Varys is there with Sisko. She says that she knows the boys were just trying to impress her. Says, didn't you ever try to impress a girl before? But she does admit in the scene that she misses her parents, and she shares how strong her dad was, and she wants to be strong like he was. And Sisko asks her if her answer is still no, and she pauses at that moment, and she says, you know what? I have an idea for an opportunity that would allow both sides to say yes. Mm. So whatever Nog said to her has turned some gears, and Sisko's advice, all those things together, she's come up with a way that maybe she can save face for her people and be strong like her dad, but solve this problem. So,
right.
I'm with you too, Armin. I like the scenes with Varys and Sisko. They were great scenes. Mm-hmm. Both of them in there.
Yeah.
We go to the village square. This is O'Brien's turn.
This scene is hilarious.
Yeah. He tells Hovath that he really should be the Sarah, but O'Brien begins to tell the story of the Dalrock, and it's just super awkward. He's not very inspiring.
I just wanted it to be more awkward. Yeah. I wanted it to be more awkward, genuinely awkward, not actory.
Yeah, I hear you.
It was comedic awkward to me, and I'm always a fan of comedy in Star Trek. Whenever there can be funny stuff.
As a comic actor on Star Trek,
the
trick to being successfully comic on Star Trek is to be utterly real.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's true.
Yeah.
That's true. And this was a little bit fronting it was kind of presenting the comedy rather than actually experiencing it, the awkwardness of it.
It was still funny and awkward, but it could have been even more.
It could have been even more.
Oh, yes.
More real.
Yes.
But Hovath, in this awkward storytelling, Hoveth says, no, something's wrong here. Bashir tells Hoveth that maybe this was Sarah's plan to pick O'Brien, knowing that O'Brien would fail and that Hoveth would have to save him.
Right.
And this makes sense to Hoveth. I love this little turn in the story.
Mm-hmm.
O'Brien falls down from this Dalrock energy blast. It's not where his storytelling is not working.
Right.
And Hoveth comes up and takes over, but he's very confident this time because Bashir's logic makes sense to him.
He also grabs the little fragment of the orb from O'Brien and puts it on his hand, palm, basically.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he does a great job, turns the Dalrock around. Everybody's safe. And now the villagers are celebrating Hoveth, the true Sarah. And O'Brien says, let's get out of here while we can. They take off.
I almost wanted to hear that cartoon sounding of the feet, like running off of them. Let's get out of here.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I felt like Armin a bit like in these two A stories, that the Varys story about her father and her parents and being the orphan, that was the one that had kind of the heart. Like to me, that was the one where I had tears or, I felt her sadness and that orphan experience. Whereas
I think when our writers wrote about family, they knew what they were talking about. It just had more oomph to it, as you said.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Go to the promenade. Varys asks Sisko if he thinks the Nevaeh will accept her plan. And her plan is free trade. Like, let's start trading and we'll give you back the land if we can just start collaborating, basically. She's kind of offering, like, if you really commit to collaborating with us, we'll give you your land back.
Yeah.
And Sisko thinks that's reasonable. Jake and Nog wait by the door of this negotiating room to wish her luck. And she thanks both of them for everything. And then she kisses Nog on the cheek, which is super sweet.
Does he have freckles that they put on him?
Yes.
That was something I never knew. And I'm looking up close at his face going, wait a minute, Nog has freckles. Wow. Okay.
Adorable.
He will never lose those freckles.
Got it.
He doesn't?
Never lose the freckles.
Wow. That's great. Well, Sisko and Varys go into the negotiation and Odo shows up and grabs the boys. Their punishment is to clean the security office till it shines. And that's it, Armin. They don't get the brig. They don't get chewed out. They just got to go. They have to go clean up the food fight.
Yeah.
Which, as we saw in the previous scene, is just really one or two or three panels at the most.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. It's not a lot in there.
Mm-hmm.
And then we see Bashir and O'Brien returning, and Bashir thinks this trip is going to make a great story for everybody. O'Brien says he doesn't want to tell any more stories.
Was this a oneer, Robbie? Was this a oneer right here?
Yeah, kind of. I think there was a little coverage with the Varys moment.
Okay.
But once Odo came up, it kind of like, turned into a handoff
From the kiss. Didn't it go over to Odo and Bashir at that point? Yes. Okay.
Yeah, it went over to, it went over the kiss and then Odo appears.
Yes.
Odo takes the boys into his room and then Bashir and O'Brien are coming out of the other.
Correct.
The other room.
It hands it off, doesn't it? At that point.
It was very elegant. Very elegant.
It was David Livingstone all over again. There you go, David.
I always felt like David Livingston to me reminds me of one of my favorite directors, Vincent Minnelli, an old golden age of Hollywood director. I was a big
Liza
fan. Liza Minnelli's dad.
Okay.
Vincent Minnelli, if you look at his work, beautifully staged oneers, the way the actors moved and the camera moved without cuts. I always thought of that when David Livingston would design these kind of moments that reminded
did Minnelli direct film or television? What did
film,
he direct?
Movies.
Film, movies.
Yeah, movies, yeah.
Is there one that stands out?
A Star is Born is, I think, his greatest
pièce de résistance. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, the original Star is Born.
All right.
But, Bashir does tell O'Brien, by the way, you don't have to call me Julian, which I thought was very funny. And O'Brien's response is, right you are. Sir. And he's back to that. We've come full circle.
Oh my goodness.
There you go. There's the episode.
Yeah.
My lesson is kind of like what you mentioned, Armin, about that scene where the description of why this Dalrock appears, our group fears, group groups working together. Mm-hmm. My theme is that groups of people need to see their common interests truly connect them. That every group, you know, you can look at politics, you can look at whatever. We all have common interests as human beings, fundamental common interests that connect us more than divide us. Mm-hmm. So that was, to me, the theme, just like with the virus story or the storyteller story. They both kind of echoed each other to me.
I would actually reiterate everything you just said. I think it's about gathering communities together and working on a problem. Although Cisco doesn't gather the community together per se, it is a community that he is a part of, including Jake and Nog. And together, the community on Deep Space Nine help solve this problem for Varys, as it does in the other story that the community gets together. I also think, something plus opportunity equals...
Instinct
plus opportunity equals profit.
I think that runs through this episode as well. So. Mm.
Instinct, yes. Yeah. What about you, Garrett?
I think my lesson is more with Varys and just knowing that sometimes, you know, you can dig in your heels all you want, but really sometimes you got to compromise. Sometimes you have to really come to the, you got to give a little to get something. I feel like a lot of times people are like, no.
Very Ferengi-like.
Yes. Yes. So that's more my theme, but I also wanted to read, Michael Piller commented, one of the really big problems with the script, which is why it didn't appeal to anybody, is because it was not about any of our characters. We were just watching the events occur by putting O'Brien in the middle, saying you have to solve it. What really appealed to me was the great theme that sometimes we create our own monsters so that we can defeat them and feel secure in our power. I was always in love with that theme, and finally we made it work. So that was my pillar.
Excuse me, the reason, forgive me, is that, again, I love Cullum. He just didn't step up to the plate for this. Mm. It was about one of our characters. It's just that Cullen didn't realize it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, I agree with you, Armin. I actually do. And I both enjoyed the episode and the comedic kind of the light touch of it, but it is a missed opportunity in terms of the kind of the depth of that story really having an impact and landing because of the choices Cullen made to keep it light and to stay sort of detached and outside of it.
Yeah.
And if he had done that, think of the reverberations in Bashir, watching this guy that he's known to be so confident and capable, all of a sudden being underwater and watching him, you know, fail, literally, and feeling for him.
Right.
My God, there was a great panoply of things that could have been done between them. Although this is the beginning of their incredibly good relationship.
Yeah. Okay.
Great. Well, there you go. There is our episode. Thank you all for joining us and listening to this episode, Storyteller. And next time we will be reviewing and discussing the episode Progress. Progress is next time. For all our Patreon patrons, stick around for that awesome, amazing, incredible, and deep
bonus material.